Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This, Trump Watch, with host Professor Parker Pollack. Hello, Professor Pollack.
Hi, Pamela.
Trump Watch airs the first Saturday of each month at 9 a.m., and I'm glad about that. I'm Pamela Spoto, and Craig Boyer will join our discussion.
Hello there, Pamela, and Professor Pollack.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
And Shane Houchins is our engineer. He's here somewhere, we hope. There are so many things, once again, to talk about, Professor Pollack, concerning this administration, and I have bulleted points of about five items, and so I'm going to read these for our listeners' audience, and you may add something else at the very end. So the first item is President Trump's economic IQ, his economic literacy. The second item is current status of health care changes. The third is Trump's obsession or anxiety with all things Russian. Fourth is concerns about Trump's mental health and or his mental quirks, depending on how you want to describe that situation. And of course, this is my favorite, we will continue the search for the great years that Trump refers to in Make America Great Again. So, Professor Pollack, with so many possibilities here, where would you like to begin?
Well, Pamela, I thought maybe we'd start off with something we touched on a little bit the last program, that is President Trump's economic education, really. And it seems to be, based on what I've heard him say, policies that he's proposed over the last 6 months, it's quite a bit different than mine. The schooling that I got when it came to using the federal government to stimulate the economy is that you didn't cut taxes when interest rates are starting to creep up and unemployment is dropping down below 5%, that you'll simply be fanning the flames, and then the Federal Reserve System will have to come in and jack up interest rates even higher. And so at that point, you're going to be looking at a federal government or Congress that's going to have to raise taxes, cut spending, which is going to hurt people who may have just gotten jobs. And so I'm really not sure whether or not his background, I don't know, it probably is somewhat similar to mine. It's just that he hasn't had a chance to express it yet. I'm giving him every break here because I'm sure once he head down the road here in the next, after their vacations are over and they come back and start talking about tax cuts, somebody is going to stand up and say, wait a minute, you guys, we got to get on the same page here.
But Professor Pollack, you are a professor of economics and political science, and that's so important in terms of the analysis. And President Trump doesn't have that background at all. I mean, I don't even know whether I want to pursue that at this moment. I'm not sure what his qualifications are in that area at all. How many bankruptcies has he had?
Six, according to the last I heard.
Okay. All right. Well,
I think his...
What concerns me about it is we're coming up on the September signing of the budget, and what are we going to do? He thinks that you can just go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And I think he has that same attitude about the United States government.
That is scary. There are some members of the Senate, maybe one or two in the House, conservative Republicans who have that same attitude. Let's just nose them up and let the government shut down when it comes to the end of the current year budget, September 30th. Usually in the past, when those threats have popped up from people with that posturing, at the last minute, things have been, they've worked out a deal here and there, and so the budget goes on. But there are some problems, of course. Anytime you have a budget, you've got a spending plan that really shows a lot about the way you think about people. And when you take a look at President Trump's budget proposals, you get the impression that he really doesn't have much regard for what the government, federal government, can do for the poor, old, the disabled, children, the most desperate in our culture. That his current budget proposal, of course, it's not law yet, but his current budget proposal is really kind of bleak, except when it comes to the military. And so there are Republicans and some Democrats, Democrats and some Republicans, who are saying his budget is dead on arrival. He sent it over here to Congress, and it's going nowhere. We got to start from scratch.
You know, I'm wondering, too, Professor Pollack, why the notion of cutting taxes is always so popular. You'd think that the public would learn by now that this is kind of a gimmick in a way, in terms of, okay, I'm going to cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes. This is going to be good for you. We're going to cut taxes. And often, as with President Trump, the cutting taxes is about cutting taxes for the very wealthy. There may be minuscule cutting of taxes for other people. But we need a certain amount of taxes in order to do those things that we need for the country. And not have it all go into the military, obviously.
Well, and on that point, during the Eisenhower administration, the top tax rate was 90%, and we were extremely prosperous. We take away the money from our government and give it to the top earners, and that's no way to go. And that's exactly what he's proposing. It flies in the face of past history, where we had a 90% tax rate for the top earners, and we did very, very well indeed.
Well, corporations certainly have nixed that through their lobbying efforts and so forth.
Well, in those days also, Craig, the good point about the 90% tax rate, there was also in those days something known as a transaction tax. We talked about it here occasionally over the last few months. But that's simply a sales tax on the transactions in the stock market. And between Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy, it was allowed to lapse. And there's the value of what's exchanged any day in the stock market is in the billions of dollars. And when you take a look at a half of 1% would generate enough money to provide Medicare for all.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah,
it would be wonderful. And especially with what's happening in the stock market, I mean, with the, what would you call it, the mechanical, the mechanical dealings that, I mean, how many thousands or hundreds of thousands per second that can be done. It's not just a person-to-person kind of dealing.
It's mechanized.
It's
computer,
amazing.
Computer-driven trading. Right.
And so it could generate an enormous amount of money that would just be just this minuscule amount that would, but overall could generate a huge amount for the public.
The point that we're sort of nibbling around the edges of here that I don't think President Trump wants to deal with is income inequality. And that, in the view of some people who've, from sociology, political science, anthropology, philosophy, religion, you can find people in all those fields and others who will say that's the biggest single problem we have in this country, is that the way income is distributed is through a system where 95% of the gains in national income in the last 12 years went to the top 1% of the population. It's really a remarkable situation. And if you go back to, 1938, anyway, Justice Louis Brandeis, he's the one that's famous for the quote, "You can have democracy or you can have the concentration of wealth into the hands of the few, but you can't have both." And so we're going down that road that, in his wisdom, we're straying from democracy, because where the money is where the political power is, and democracy implies the consent of the governed and the will of the people. Neither of those things is going to happen with this kind of concentration. And we've seen it with Citizens United, the corporations are people.
Yes. Yeah. And when we start talking about these kinds of things, unfortunately, those that control the media, for example, or the wealthy, talk about, well, this is just class warfare. This is just class warfare. Mm-hmm. When indeed, and they try to stop the conversation that way. And I'm thinking about Reagan and his trickle-down economics. But it really is. I was thinking about this morning. I don't know why. But it's like gobble up. And that's what these policies and rules and regulations have sent money to the wealthy, as you just mentioned. It's not trickle-down.
No. No, it doesn't. And that idea of trickle-down economics came out of, I don't want to blame USC for this, but it came from Arthur Laffer, the econ department there back in the 80s and Reagan years, where he began this idea where you saturate the field of economics with the idea of stimulating investment, and that'll be the way to have more jobs and more income. The evidence just doesn't support the Laffer philosophy, or what's called the Laffer curve. And most economists these days are describing a situation where If you want the stuff that you've manufactured in your shop, you have a shoe manufacturing company and you've got a warehouse full of shoes, if you want to keep the workers employed that make those shoes, you've got to sell the shoes that are in the warehouse to people out in Reading and in Minnesota and all around the country. And the people out there will buy the shoes if they have some money. Right. Regular people will buy the shoes if they have some money. And so you work at it. You work at improving people's situation in the country by stimulating demand, and investment will take care of itself. Right now, there's $1 trillion sitting offshore in banks in the Caribbean and other places, because if it comes back into this country, it was made by multinational companies who exist here. If it comes back into the country, then there'll be a tax upon it. And so it's sitting out there waiting for some investment opportunity that's greater than the amount of tax they'd have to pay if they brought it in. Well, there isn't any reason today for them to bring that money back into the country, because they can borrow money from a bank here at almost zero interest rates, which makes the penalty that they're going to pay if they bring that other money in silly. They wouldn't even consider it. And so if, I'm not suggesting this, but if the Federal Reserve System begins to creep up the interest rate, then at some point you're going to see the offshore money begin to trickle back in. Hopefully it will be invested in things that create more jobs. But there is one thing that probably, well, I guess if we want to talk about President's budget, I see nothing in there about the earned income tax credit. In fact, there was one commentator who suggested that the earned income tax credit be reduced. And that's the that's from the President Nixon Milton Friedman era, where you have a subsidy payment to the working poor. If you have a job and you fill out your tax form, your 1040, and let's say you're a family of four, two adults and a couple of kids, and you don't make $40,000, then you make $20,000, let's say, then the government will send you a check for $20,000. It's not that large today. It's about the minimum of probably $22,000 or $23,000 a year. So it's helpful, but it's not helping the working poor the way it could if we had an income distribution process that was a little more equitable. And that's typically, it's no secret, countries use the income tax process for income redistribution. I mean, it's just historically, if you look at the countries of Western Europe, the democracies, and the United States, Canada, and Australia, that's how you do it. You don't ask people who make, you know, $4 or $5 million a year, you don't ask them, well, would you kick in $1 million over here? I mean, mm-hmm. That's silly. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, yeah. I hope that that President Trump's economic literacy is greater than what he's revealed so far. And if it isn't, there may be people, maybe Mulvaney, the Office of Management Budget, maybe his director there, who has a background in econ as well, maybe Mulvaney can help him get squared away on the idea of tax cuts at this point. Just, wouldn't make any sense at all. So,
because, Professor Pollack, I was wondering about how President Trump does increase his economic literacy, or whether he just gives that to somebody else to shape and just signs off
mm-hmm,
on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, he's about 70 years old, so he was born around 1947. And at that point, his grandfather hadn't yet passed away. But his grandfather, who they're from Germany, the Trump name didn't have a T before. It was a D, Drump.
Drump.
Drump. And so for some reason, they changed the D as in dog to a T as in Tom. When they came over here, and the grandfather did fairly well with cafes and the kind of friendly heterosexual relationships that occur up over, well, he ran a whorehouse. at any rate, he did get in trouble in either the Northwest or in Alaska, one of the two, Oregon, Washington, or Alaska, can't remember where. He tried to go back to Germany, but he had such a bad reputation that they turned him down and they sent him back to America, where he had he got married and then had Donald Trump's father as his son. And Donald Trump's dad now he didn't deal with whorehouses and all that. He started off milking the government. New York City, up until about 1975, had a housing program that Donald's dad really did understand and really did figure out how to make some money out of it. And so with government help, just like Phil Ryan's dad in Wisconsin, his dad made all his money through the government as well. So you have a situation there with Donald Trump's dad, where he's making lots of money over this housing project. And then along comes Donald, gets out of college in the late 60s. And by 1972 or so, he's trying to get into that housing game the same way his dad milked the city of New York. And just about the time Donald tried to get into it, son of a gun, they ended it. The city of New York, if you may remember, went into semi-bankruptcy in the mid-70s. They had just built the Twin Towers with the New Jersey Port Authority, and the Twin Towers were not being occupied right away. So anyway, they got into some trouble there. But Donald then had to try to go ahead and make it a money in another way. In his first venture, the bank wouldn't lend him any money unless Hyatt Hotels and his dad co-signed his first loan, because he had no background. He had a degree from, I think it's a name university in the East. I can't remember what it is, Pennsylvania, Wharton School. Anyway, so he got his start that way with the help of his dad, I think somewhere between $9 and $14 million. And not to take anything away from him, he is a good financier, except when it comes to casinos and pro football and airlines and colleges. Those four industries, those were his failures. And so it looked like every time he tried to get in and manage one of his investments, then it went belly up. So.
And he seems to have a history of not paying some of the construction workers and the workers that helped build these various sites that he wanted to use for different kinds of things, because they have filed lawsuits and so forth against him. Let me remind the audience that this is KKRN.org, Community Radio, Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and we are volunteer supported. Right now, you are listening to Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Parker Pollack. I'm Pamela Spoto, and Craig Boyer is also in the studio. Pollack.
So Donald does have a history of being able to figure out how to get people to finance things for him.
Yes.
And some of the banks have, they've had some problems with bankruptcies and so forth with Donald. And so it's very difficult for him to borrow money in the United States. And so he has had some luck borrowing from Deutsche Bank in Germany. And there might even be, a couple of years ago, his son Eric mentioned to a golfing friend that they get a lot of money from Russia. So there's another possible link there for investment money from Russia, some from Germany, and so he can continue. But one of the things that happened to him after the bankruptcies that you've mentioned is that he realized that he doesn't have to build buildings anymore. All he has to do is sell his name. And so the brand, the Trump brand, is now worth something. And so it's on buildings in the Middle East. Well, it's not on any of the buildings that are on the list from which immigrants are banned. If you take a look at those seven countries, there's not a Trump hotel in those countries. Now, Qatar, yes, we got Trump hotels, but they're free to come here.
Did he forget that he had his hotels in Qatar when he was saying that he was listening to Saudi Arabia and saying that Qatar was a hotbed of terrorists?
Well, he could have. The other day, he said that he got a phone call from the head of the Boy Scouts.
And he didn't.
And he didn't. So I'm not sure, you know.
This is worrisome. But go ahead.
So anyway, yes, he has had a very interesting career, and he does do well, or he has done well, at getting other people to help him finance a golf course or a building. And now he and his family has figured out that selling the name Trump is another way to make money. And so his kids and his grandson, or his son-in-law, they have interests in what I think clothing,
yes,
in China and Manhattan, yes, buildings and things like that. So, yeah, unlike the Clintons, remember when the Clintons left the White House, one of them mentioned that they didn't have a dime. Well, they do now, of course, but when President Trump leaves the White House, I doubt that he will say, "I don't have a dime."
Well, it's so curious, though. I don't know what I'm missing here, because the notion of selling his name is like, that conjures up this reality TV host that just had this mm-hmm. ugly mm-hmm. look on his face mm-hmm. and saying, you're fired. I mean, that is very unappealing to me when I think of Trump and the name of Trump.
Well, it's a thing that's happening now, though.
His name, because he's the president of the United States.
Well, even before that, a very popular tennis shoe. They're made Nike. They're made in like 600 different factories. None of them are owned by Nike. Nike doesn't produce shoes. They sold the brand to companies that put it on their shoes. It seemed to be a practice that's picking up speed. I have a good friend from high school who has Phil, I'm giving you a plug. That's his profession. He's a brander. He has a branding agency in San Francisco, and that's what they do. They'll help you sell your image.
So Nike is no longer owned by Nike, but somebody bought the name of Nike and is able to continue on.
I don't know. That's an interesting point because I don't know whether Nike did that, and I'm not sure whether President Trump has done it. But that's one of the things Mueller may run into is that when in the investigation, he may run into that idea or the fact that President Trump may have sold the branding rights to his name to a foreign entity. I guess we'll get into that a little bit later, too. Anyway, so...
Okay.
Well, I guess we probably ought to move on to the current status of health care. So far, President Trump's striking out. He was 0 for 2 on the health care battle.
Well, this was another, what would we call it, buried tax cut for the wealthy, for the oligarchs? There were like billions, was it not, that mm-hmm. of tax breaks for the extremely mm-hmm. wealthy sure. tucked into that health care.
If they could pull away health care to the Medi-Cal or Medicare mm-hmm. people, yeah.
And hopefully that they were going to fund this huge tax break through Social Security cuts. And I'm going, you have to be kidding me. Once again, it's taking from the lesser and lesser in the sense of having less money and giving more to the already wealthy. Yeah, it's just astounding.
Various presidents over the years have used that tactic you mentioned, Pamela, about we'll just do something to Social Security. Well, if you go back to 1967, 66, 67, President Johnson was trying to figure out how to pay for his war in Vietnam, and he noticed in the federal budget there was this huge pot of money in the Social Security Administration. And so that pot of money is what financed the war in Vietnam.
What an absolutely terrible thing.
So if you look at that basket that used to contain those millions and millions of dollars that people put in there for their retirement, sitting in that basket now is a pile of IOUs, treasury notes, bonds.
As a result of the Vietnam
War. Right. So about 3 years ago, the total amount of money being collected by people that work and contribute to Social Security fell short of the amount that those who are retired and getting Social Security checks were taking out of the pot. So about 3 years ago, they had to go over to that basket and start getting some of those bonds out of there and cashing those in to make the payments to the people who are retired. So as we head towards 2042 or 2038, depending on who you listen to, at any rate, sometime in the next 20 years, there's going to be a point where that basket of bonds is going to be empty. And that the people who are retiring will have consumed it because the people who are working won't have put enough in.
Does the problem lie then with what President Johnson did in terms of taking that money to support the war in Vietnam? Mm-hmm. Had he not done that, would Social Security be flush now? I mean,
yes.
So the then I don't quite understand then what in 2042, I mean, if there are indeed IOUs there because the government took that to support mm-hmm. wars, then mm-hmm. the government did put that back in there.
Well, they do when the Social Security Administration, like they started doing a couple of years ago, the Social Security Administration said, President, Obama, we don't have enough revenue from the current employees to pay for the current retirees. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have to cash some of those bonds that your predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, gave us. So here's X million dollars worth of bonds. And Obama goes to the Secretary of the Treasury who makes the conversion into cash. Mm-hmm. And the money gets paid that way. Eventually, though, the bonds they'll be gone. Yeah. And you could simply take away the limit on how much money you make and contribute to Social Security based on that.
Yes.
Right now it's $110,000 or something. You just take the limit off altogether. If you make, who knows, whatever it is you make, that would help a bit. Mm-hmm. At some point.
That would, more than just a bit, according to what Bernie Sanders was saying, it would help it indefinitely.
Well, there's another aspect of the problem, and that is the salaries of people who are working are shrinking and their contributions are shrinking. And the labor force that we're generating because of some problems we're probably going to get into next month and next program, because of some problems that started 40 years ago, our labor force is becoming, I don't want to be too drastic here, but they're becoming less able to make contributions to their own retirement. The likelihood of taking the cap off Social Security contributions is probably pretty slim, because you have to ask the people that you're going to damage if you can damage them. And usually they say no.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And so then there's this total push for privatization of Social Security, which is another road that I wouldn't want to go down.
Yeah.
But
back on the health care coverage, we didn't get a resolution to that since our last program. And I still recommend, for people that are interested in the ins and outs of this, Stephanie Woolhandler and Jack Rasmus. Woolhandler is just like you might expect somebody who raises sheep, as in yours truly used to do. Somebody who raises sheep handles wool. Stephanie's last name is Woolhandler. Rasmus is Rasmus. She's a physician. She's the president of Physicians for a Sane Healthcare Policy. She's also practicing professor of medicine. Rats, I can't remember, on the East Coast somewhere. Rasmus is economist, political science guy at Santa Clara, University of Santa Clara, California. Anyway, those two are just super. And again, I say that there is no role, no ethical, legitimate economic role for insurance in providing health care. Mm-hmm. It's just, we have to get over it. There are a couple of ways that in this, what could be a crisis for healthcare, there are a couple of ways that we can work our way towards single payer or Medicare for all, and that is if the repeal of apparently it didn't work this last go around, but if we continue to muddle along this way, the insurance companies are going to continue to drop out. In the ACA, in Obamacare, in the law, there's nothing that requires them to offer health insurance, as you might imagine, because they're the ones that wrote the bill. At any rate, so when you take a look at them dropping out of the exchanges, there are going to be more and more people that have nowhere to go to buy insurance. And so that, I guess I would call that a crisis that might gather some attention from all kinds of different stripes of politicians, to the point where if you can't con the insurance companies into providing health insurance with large enough profit margins, let's sit down and scrap Obamacare and go for a single payer. So we have one way of getting there would be to simply muddle along, let the insurance companies drop out, and then deal with it then. Or when the people, politicians, come back from their vacation, if they are successful in repealing Obamacare lock, stock, and barrel, then we're going to be a blank slate. Let's start. There's another chance to start over.
Yes, and that is true. And we only have a couple of minutes before we're going to take a short break. But I wanted to ask you, is it possible, or would it even be worthwhile, for example, like a state like California, if they would do it, to just decide to have single payer in California? Is that a way to go as well? Or are you seeing it more? I mean, obviously it would be more beneficial if the whole nation had single payer. But what about state by state?
No, I think that's, California's led the way in a number of things. Education for one.
Yes.
In fact, where you and I spent some time in the California Community College system, 80% of the people in California live within 20 miles of a college campus. And there's not another state that can say that. So, yeah, we do lead the way. We could do the same thing, lead the way in single-payer health care. And with our college system, sure, it attracts people from out of state, but they pay a whopping tuition fee.
Yes,
they pay the full cost of instruction is essentially what it is. So that kind of an attitude or a program aspect, if we went to single payer in California, sure, you might get some people who are attracted here thinking they can ride the boat for free. But there are ways to write the program up that could, okay, for the most part, you can't stop all of that,
right,
sort of thing,
right,
but for the most part would make it still feasible. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, Professor Pollack, we're going to take a short break. And for our listening audience, this is just to remind you that this is KKRN.org and you're listening to Trump Watch. So enjoy the music as we take a short break.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on the sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. Let me not greed lead the way. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much and how much longer?
Welcome back to KKRN.org with Trump Watch, Dig This Trump Watch, with Professor Parker Pollack. I'm Pamela Spoto, and in the studio with Craig Boyer. So, Professor Pollack, where would you like to go in the second half?
Okay, well, I'd like to start with this topic of undeclared endless wars that we seem to have gotten into since President Bush II was in the White House. We have every year, there's something called the Authorization for Use of Military Force, AUMF. That's an annual declaration of this is how much money we're going to spend. These are the agencies that are responsible for defense, and these are the policies that we want them to spend the money on. It's kind of a very general thing. But back in September, after 9/11, the incident in 9/11/01, on the 14th of September, the Congress passed and President Bush signed what's known as the Authorization for Use of Military Force, and that's a joint resolution, number 23. It authorizes the Defense Department to go after the people that perpetrated the incidents on 9/11 and other, let me see if I can get any other associated forces. Okay, and that's been the document that has just every president since Bush the second has used that document, 91401, as the justification for killing people in other countries and getting our troops killed. And what some people, I'm thinking of a fellow I really respect, Andrew Basevich, military background, West Point, Vietnam, injured, came back, went to college, got a doctorate, PhD in history, teaches history now somewhere in Boston. One of those, they have more than one campus there, what, 8 or 9, somewhere in Boston anyway. And so, but where Basevich will argue, and he has argued in his books, that our troops are being abused, that the idea of endless wars is something that has been killing American men and women in uniform since 9/11. And it's time for, hopefully, and Barbara Lee, God bless her, wait, I don't want to get him involved in this, but Barbara Lee tried to get a reauthorization of that pronouncement or of that joint resolution. And son of a gun, it was in a bill. It was proceeding along through the House. And Barbara is from House of Representatives from Southern California, I think.
Yes,
anyway,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
And she voted against initially.
Yeah, she did.
Exactly. One of the single people.
She may
to
have
do.
Been the only one, yeah. Right. So, anyway, that her bill to seek reauthorization for that, get the discussion going about this, was the writer in a bill. It moved along in the House at the last minute, June 29th, the day before we did our last recording, Paul Ryan pulled it, jerked it off the bill, and didn't go anywhere. So there we are. We still have that particular document which justifies the endless wars. The AU, Authorization for Use of Military Force, 91401. And it's going to allow us to stumble into wars through incident creation. I'd like to think that I've used that phrase before. And, of course, there are a couple of English words, and other people can use it, but incident creation, if you remember the Gulf of Tonkin situation in Vietnam.
Yes.
In August of 1964. Well, the AUMF that Bush Jr. got is almost exactly like the Tonkin Gulf resolution that President Johnson got from Congress after those alleged attacks in the South China Sea in the Gulf of Tonkin in August of 1964. One may have happened, and one probably didn't, but... he knew that the attacks were provoked because he knew that we were running O-Plan 34A raids up the coast of Vietnam. I have him on tape saying that. But when he got that Gulf of Tonkin resolution, I'm sure he felt like President Bush and presidents subsequent to Bush Jr., that resolution, as President Johnson said, it's like my grandmother's nightgown. It covers everything. He had a way, didn't he, of coming up with phrases?
Yes, I think so.
So at any rate, that, and I think, I will, I'm sure you guys will too, watch Secretary of Defense Mattis.
Mattis,
yeah, thank you. I want to put an H in his name for some reason. But Mattis, there are incidents going on right now in the Persian Gulf. He has a tremendous hatred for Iran because of the hostage crisis back many years ago in the late 1970s. And we might want to talk about that someday as well. But he can't get over that. And so I'm nervous that President Trump has given his cabinet members, including the Secretary of Defense, way too much latitude or free rein in their judgments about how to pursue what they think President Trump's agenda is in all the specific areas of the government, all the cabinet members. And so one of the things that happens with this sort of a president who starts a new fire every day, well, the California Department of Forestry or the media have to run around and follow President Trump's new fires, and all the while they don't have the time or the staff to take a look at what's happening with the environment, with the EPA, what's happening with Mattis, what's happening with Tillerson, Secretary of State, what's happening with the Department of the Interior, Pruitt. And so those people, DeVos, mm-hmm, Betsy, mm-hmm. in education, the media doesn't have time to keep us up to date, and so it's going to be, you really have to dig.
And it seems that it's almost a purposeful distraction, all of these things that are going on with the press is following around and worried about this and worried about that, where these really important, significant issues are happening. And I was thinking about, you know, the endless wars as well. And in some ways, they become so distant and so quiet, you know, from the media and from the population. I haven't heard anything about Yemen recently, and yet we're funding Saudi Arabia, helping Saudi Arabia buy all these weapons. And I think at last count, there were, 600,000 cases of cholera?
Wow.
And
wow.
It was the largest cholera incident in known history from the bombing by Saudi Arabia of this very poor country. Mm-hmm. But we don't get that information. So you're very correct.
Yeah, well,
all of these things are going on. But we're distracted.
Well, and we, like in the case of Yemen, good point, Pamela, that really for Obama and for Trump, and maybe even for Bush Jr., was a proxy war with Iran. Since Iran and Yemen have treaties with one another, they're both have an interest in the Persian Gulf. And at any rate, it's like the proxy wars in Vietnam. We were really fighting China or Korea. That war, we really were fighting against China. And with the war in Vietnam, we were at war with both Russia and China. Not out in the open, of course, but
proxy.
They stood in for the Vietnamese people stood in for Russia and China.
I wanted to bring up something about this endless war. On PBS News last night, they had a retired general with Judy Woodruff, and he was insisting that we can win in Afghanistan if we send additional 20,000 more troops, and that we never agree to leave, and that will win the war.
Boy, wow, that's incredible.
That was on PBS News last night.
Okay, yeah. He's active duty?
No, he's retired, but he's a consultant.
Oh, Jack.
Jack something.
Gotcha.
Yes.
And, right.
And he's insisting that that's what we need to do and never agree to leave, and that will win the war. And Judy Woodruff didn't say anything. She didn't say, well, wait a minute. Now, we've been forever and ever, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. And as soon as we pull back, the insurgents or the people that want to take over their own country are back at it again.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there you go.
Interesting statement. The people who want to take over their own country, take back their own country. And that goes back once again to this hugely bloated military budget with all of these bases around the world, well, all these countries that we have gone into, but not the countries that are like Saudi Arabia, that are considered our friend, even though when we point to dictatorships, Venezuela, dictatorship, North Korea, awful. And I'm not saying that there aren't problems with those, but we make a distinction between which dictators, if there are dictator, right?
what's the word? We wink. Yeah.
In
Saudi Arabia, they, you know, last spring, they had a job ad, help wanted ad out on the internet that they were running out of swordsmen. And they have weekly beheadings, and so I'm not sure what the training program is for. Major League Baseball provide that kind of skill, but they finally did hire enough swordsmen so they can now keep on conducting their beheadings. They had 12; they were backed up 12 deep about 3 or 4 weeks ago, but I think they've solved that. So.
And the U.S. was so outraged by beheadings in other situations in the Middle East, but our ally, quote unquote.
Yeah. And you can be beheaded for apostasy. If it looks like you're straying from the Quran, you may be history.
From their version of the Quran.
Yeah, their version. Yeah, don't lose your head over it. Literally.
Yeah.
Well, any rate, we've got that dilemma then with stumbling into wars, and this is probably not something new. If you went back to, the Marine Corps hymn, "The Shores of Tripoli." Mm-hmm. If you went back to Thomas Jefferson and we were being charged a fee to pass through the Straits of Gibraltar to get into the Mediterranean, as were other countries. And so in 1796, Washington's in the White House, and and Jefferson and Adams, John Adams, meet in London with a representative of the Tripoli government. I don't know whether they were called Libya yet, but Tripoli now part of Libya. So they meet with a representative from that leader, and they ask him, by what rule or what sense of law do you stop our ships, kidnap our people, turn them into slaves, kill some of them, demand a payment? By what? And the fellow looked at him and said, it's in the Quran. If you're a non-believer, we're compelled to do those things to you. And Adams, at that point when they left, and Jefferson a few years later, 4 years later, became president, John Adams reminded Jefferson, you remember what that guy said, but let me tell you, if you take those people on, you're going to have to fight them forever. And this is like 1800. So, at any rate, Jefferson wasn't going to be talked out of it. He sent the Navy off with the troops that were later to become the Marines. He sent those ships off without getting any approval from Congress. That when they were far enough out, he sent a ship back that could not get to him with the stop notice from Congress by the time he got to Tripoli. So he did send word back, hey, you know what I've done? I've sent the troops off to go to war in Tripoli, and we're going to open up the Mediterranean, which he did, or they did. And so the idea of undeclared war has got a long history, probably not just in our country, but other countries as well.
You mentioned the proxy wars, and then I'm wondering, too, about economic proxy, and I don't know whether we want to talk about this at this point, but these recent sanctions that have come down against Russia, Iran, and North Korea. But it's very interesting that the sanctions against Russia, and there are these economic sanctions that have to do with energy, and it's a pipeline but being built between Germany and Russia, energy going to the United Kingdom or Britain, however you want to say it. The United Kingdom or let's say the European countries are really outraged by this, because this was their way of getting energy, you know, through this pipeline that Germany and Russia. So these sanctions allegedly halt that, and if they do, that opens that up for the U.S. to sell energy, natural gas, and so forth.
Point.
So it's another kind of proxy war in a way. We're just going to, and the sanctions, though, you know, well, Putin is doing this or that, but when you look underneath that, there's so much more involved than that.
Mm-hmm.
You
know, that's a good point, Pamela, right.
So, and I don't know what's going to happen with that, because the Europe is getting very upset with the idea that the United States is now affecting their ability to buy energy, to receive energy from the investments that they have already made.
Who
knows?
So you have that, there are two things that could happen. One, there will be oil that will be snuck out of Russia in some large quantity, and people will be paid to, what's the word I'm looking for here?
In the black market?
Thank you. The black market will supply oil. You can never break the laws of supply and demand. You heard it here first. They'll pay more, but they'll get it. That's one of the things that could happen. The sanctions also, they come in a number of varieties. First of all, trade sanctions against not just oil, but other things as well.
Right.
Also, money transfers between countries, between Russia and other countries, and then technology transfers or intelligence gains with high-tech stuff. That's travel restrictions and freezing assets in the country. That, like in the United States, we might freeze the bank accounts of some of the wealthy, the 12 wealthy families from Russia, including Putin. And so those are the kind of things that because Putin's money is mixed with apparently other of the oligarchs' investments. And so when you freeze the oligarchs' investment, you're freezing Putin too, and his cash flow is reduced. So that could be a real bite, unless nobody's going to monitor, like nobody monitored the restrictions against oil coming out of Iraq going into to the Mediterranean through Turkey that way. During those restrictions, they had trucks with phony phony belly pans in them. They were just hauling oil night and day. But it is a statement that we're upset with you.
And it is, and it's really too bad, because when countries really want to collaborate or negotiate or communicate with one another, and it seems like, in my opinion, the policy of the U.S. is to prevent some of that collaboration and communication. Another example would be North Korea. From what I hear, the president of the current president of South Korea wants more of a communication with North Korea, and the United States is just like, wait. No, we don't want you to do that. So it's really very unfortunate. And Professor Pollack, we have maybe 9 minutes left, so I'm going to let you go in the direction that you want to go.
Well, we started off talking about Trump's economic literacy, and there is, because he has gotten so cranky with Mexico, I'm not sure whether he understands how that works, where we have corn that's subsidized in this country by the government. We ship it to Mexico. The people who in Mexico who grow their own corn can't compete because we can sell our corn cheaper than they can. So those farmers are out of business. They then are forced to come north into the United States and work on the very farms that are producing the corn that put them out of business. I'm not sure that President Trump sees those cycles, that these things are connected. Things just don't occur in isolation.
And there's a terribly tragic part, if it can be a terrible tragedy versus not so terrible of a tragedy, is that the corn that's subsidized by the U.S. and grown in the U.S., most of that is genetically modified corn. In Mexico, you had hundreds of varieties of corn over hundreds of years produced, and now they're getting this mixed in with the genetically modified corn. It's become a real problem, too. Mm-hmm. So this is not good. This is not good for Mexico.
No, right.
Okay. And in any sense of it.
Well, we'll come back to his economic policies and attitudes and education, I'm sure. We did have on the list some of the quirks about President Trump's personality, and there was an article in the New York Times, July 19 this year, 7,500-word article written by Haberman, Baker, and Schmidt of the interview that they had with President Trump, and apparently it is, if you have the time, it is really well worth reading, or at least you can get reduced versions of it over the internet, but it's really worth it.
Could you mention the title of that again, or the authors of that again? I'm sorry.
The authors are, I forget their first names, but are Haberman, H-A-B-E-R, Haberman, Baker, and Schmidt, like the former second baseman for the Detroit Tigers.
Okay.
If you say so.
No idea.
Okay. Well, anyways, some of the quirks of President Trump's personality really have struck us all, I'm sure. Comey, former FBI director, did mention in some idle conversation that President Trump wanted loyalty, and he demands loyalty from all of his people that work for him, yet it appears to be just a one-way street, that the loyalty doesn't come the other way. And so it's one of those things that probably can come back to haunt you. He's turned on
Sessions
for sure, and then six other people that he axed. And the thing that really struck me as being interesting in how the White House works is that one day you can hire a new communications director, a guy named Scaramucci, and he's on the job a couple of days, and he fires the White House chief of staff. The White House chief of staff is then replaced by a guy from Homeland Security who, the third day on his job, he fires the communications director. There isn't a really good personnel chart here for who reports to who. I'm sure all of those things were orchestrated by the president, but in the news media would say Scaramucci fires Priebus or Kelly fires Scaramucci, and so it looked like all these things were going on. They might have actually had weapons of some sort.
They had a cartoon in the Searchlight, and he was a guy was painting on the door Scaramucci, and he hadn't quite finished it, and they said he's gone, and he's damn.
I have a full time career here.
Yeah. So Professor Pollack, are you suggesting, and maybe even more than suggesting, that Trump was aware of how this would play out?
Well, I would like to praise the guy's creativity by saying yes, I think he orchestrated the whole thing.
Wow.
But I don't think he's that bright.
Well, it hinges on how well he knew Scaramucci. Because
They talk the same language. Well, but go ahead.
Yeah, they do have some aberrant ideas of what you can say in public.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Right. So at any rate, that's my number one quirk. I'm sure we've all noticed that thing about him demanding loyalty but not giving it. And then he seems to have a delusional and elevated regard for his own abilities. In fact, he'll say that my speech in Poland was the greatest speech ever given by a U.S. president on foreign soil, that somebody told him that. The Boy Scouts, the leader of the Boy Scouts told me that was the greatest speech that any president had ever given at a jamboree.
And didn't the Boy Scouts say they never said that?
Exactly, yeah.
Not only that, they apologized to everybody that was there then had to listen to that speech.
Yeah, right,
they,
right.
They said
right.
This was not right.
So, see, yeah. I don't understand that. I just don't understand that.
But shortly after that happened, then, maybe 2 days ago, he said he got a phone call from the head of the Boy Scouts, and everything is hunky-dory, and the phone call apparently never happened. And the new Sean Spicer, a lady named Huckabee, she had to dance around that one the other day in her press conference. She's pretty good at that dance, mm-hmm. and she may last a while.
Well, don't Trump supporters or, I don't know, the American public, I mean, what about this? I mean, it's just, once again, what is truth and what is not truth? And what, I mean, people are saying, no, that didn't happen. And Trump goes, yes, it did. Or mm-hmm. I had the most people at my inauguration or whatever the case may be in the camera show. Mm-hmm. You did not. Mm-hmm. But he just continues to, it's hyperbole of some sort.
Lies. And here's the thing about it that I'm wondering about. You know, he's going to be called in with a grand jury at some point, and his minions are. And I'm thinking he'll likely do is plead the Fifth Amendment, because if he says anything, it'll be a lie. And so, of course, he'd go to prison for that, or he should be going to prison for it. So I think that the only thing he can do is to plead the Fifth Amendment and then pardon all the people that will be convicted. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. my thought on what's
sure,
going to happen.
Sure, yeah. That pardoning may have been what cost Ford his own election mm-hmm. Because of what he did with President Nixon. Yeah, yeah. So it seems to be delusional that he's not, like you say, Pamela, he's not in touch with the world, with the real world. And then thirdly, I noted I'm not sure he's aware of the gaping holes in his general knowledge. He's got Andrew Jackson involved in the Civil War. I don't know. He confuses whole life insurance with health insurance.
Yes.
That really surprised me. And then on April 30th of this year, he's quoted as saying, "Our system of checks and balances is archaic. Is an archaic system. It's really a bad thing for the country." He has shown some evidence for a more authoritarian style of president. He has praised people like Duterte and Sisi and Putin and Erdogan and people that I don't think we would want their styles of government to even, you know, no. Just not something that we're tuned into, that kind of authoritarian dictatorship. But he seems to have a preference for the style, and he keeps running into these blocks where the Congress will not be directed by him. They refuse to call him every morning and find out what they're supposed to do today.
You know, it is so fascinating, because I remember President Obama at one point on his lapel, on his suit lapel, didn't have an American flag. And oh my goodness, the outrage. And here President Trump says, the White House is a dump.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Constitution, or the three branches of government mm-hmm. are just archaic.
Archaic. Camp David is a trailer park. And now, the White House and Camp David, he said he didn't say those things. But they've got him on tape. It's the darndest thing. And some records were released the other day about his early days in the White House when he met with the president of Mexico over how Mexico was going to pay for the wall. And he told the president of Mexico, don't say that in public, that you're not going to pay for the wall. Don't do that. I can't have you saying that in public. He says that to the leader of another country and expected it to have an effect.
Oh, my. And Professor Pollack, we have about 15 seconds.
Oh, well.
Wow, we've been really moving along here today with all kinds of information.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe next time we could continue the quirks thing, but the quirks thing is going to lead into a study of his mental health.
Okay. Yeah. You heard it first here, or maybe second. Who knows? And this is Dig This, Trump Watch with Professor Parker Pollack. I am Pamela Spoto in the studio with Craig Boyer. This is KKRN Community Radio Round Mountain. Tune in next Saturday for Pearl on Politics with Professor David Pearl.